nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Now I'm just going to do a sort of a reminder of some of the quantum mechanics some of you might have even heard in high school. So this is what are waves, what's quantization, what are artificial atoms, and really a reminder of some very basic quantum mechanics to get everybody on the same footing. Let me go through the presentation outline. I'm going to talk a little bit about classical systems, particles, propagating waves, standing waves, and chromatography. And then some strange experimental results, which really led to quantum mechanics, which deals with discrete optical spectra, the photoelectric effect, and the particle-wave duality. And then I'll talk a little bit about heterostructures and quantum dots. What's a quantum dot? What's a resonant tunneling diode? And then some examples and applications. And finally, I'm going to motivate some of the work in NEMO with resonant tunneling diodes and quantum dots as well. So let's talk about classical macroscopic particles. They have properties we all know and love, right? They have a finite extent. They have a finite weight. And they're countable with integers, right? That's generally how we think about classical particles. And they behave classical Newtonian motions, right? Which is the first things you learn in physics. And they interact with other particles by energy conservation and momentum conservation. Right? Those are two fundamental conservation laws which you learn when you study physics. Some examples are billiard balls, right? And what to take away from this is this finite extent but it's continuous, right? It's finite extent, but you can chop a little bit off of this table, right? And you can do that at any measure principle. You don't think of atoms. There's no discreteness, right? Any arbitrary length will just be fine. And it has a finite weight, right? You can subdivide anything you want. You'll never, in normal life, hit to any discreteness. And it's discrete, right? It's countable, right? Unless you deal with fluid, it's something you can count and number, right? So that's what we know and love about classical macroscopic particles. We also know about waves, right? So like a plane wave, a sine wave here, where we know they have really an infinite extent, right? In a standard plane wave is infinitely extended. But they have a finite wavelength, and they are at a finite frequency, right? That's our normal way of thinking at a wave that is described by a wave equation, and you might have a solution that is just some sinusoid that propagates with a certain momentum and at a certain energy or frequency. So this is just classical propagating plane waves. And we know that they interact with other waves or the environment. We know that there can be a coherent superposition. So you can have interference and constructive and destructive interference. We even know that they can cancel out each other, right? Two waves add, and you can have these modulations, and these waves can cancel out, right? I mean, there's nothing essential quantum mechanics about this. This is just normal properties of waves. And we know of the Huygens principle that one plane wave can make up many can be made up by many circular waves, which allows us to really describe diffraction and that waves can go around corners. All right, let's assume that you've heard of Huygens principle. So this animation was supposed to show how these waves propagate out just from a single stone's throw in water, and the next one is an animation that's pretty nice where you can really see nicely how these wave fronts add, and the human eye can really see very nicely how a plane wave is starting to move. It's a very powerful animation. So now let's talk about propagating plane waves and light being an electromagnetic wave. So in the late 1800s, it was understood that light is an electromagnetic wave, and the Maxwell's equations were formulated. And again, these properties are that they have an infinite extent, and they have a finite wavelength, and have a finite frequency. They obey this law of motion, and they have interference effects. So here, you can have this double split experiment, and if it's a wave theory, it predicts that there's interference, you have these fringes. If it were a classical particle theory, it would not show fringes, it would be just sort of a bulge of light. And the experiment really showed, well, there is fringes. So that was considered the proof that light is an electromagnetic wave. Right, that experiment of a double split experiment was the proof that light is an electromagnetic wave. So again, it's important to realize that they are not countable. They have an infinite extent. They have a finite wavelength, meaning they're continuous, and you can give it any frequency, but it's continuous. And they have a finite frequency, it's also continuous. There's nothing that prevents you to go from 1.1 megahertz to 1.112 megahertz, right? It's completely continuous. You pick a number, you can choose it, right? All right, now let's look at a property of standing waves. You might have a guitar string or something which has a finite boundary condition on these waves. And we understand that these standing waves have a finite extent, right? They live in a discrete space, right? It's finite. It just doesn't propagate everywhere. It's finite. It's discrete wavelengths. We know there's a half wave, a quarter wave length that fits into these standing waves. And associated with that, you have discrete frequencies, right? So they obey the same law of motion, but the wave function that you associate with that looks different. It's not a propagating wave, it's a standing wave. Okay? And it's defined in a finite space and it's zero everywhere else. Okay? That's distinctly different than a propagating wave. It's a standing wave. And we do know that these can interact with the environment by coherent superpositions, right? Sounds add an instrument. Like that's how a guitar works. You strike the string and the vibrations excite the acoustic body of the guitar, and that is what you hear, right? So these are coupled resonators, right? And they talk to each other. They're in tune, right? A musical instrument is tuned. So a standing wave in it can be a resonator, it can be coupled. And there's energy transfer between these resonators, right? And there's somewhat of an energy conservation again, right? But it's associated with waves. Not just with particles, but also with waves. Standing waves in this case. All right. So the thing to take away here is that this momentum here is quantized, right? It's discrete. And by the way, it can't take on any value anymore, just any old value. It's very discrete. And that discreteness is determined by the propagation velocity in this environment and its length. Okay? But it's not continuous anymore. All right. So, white light consists of a broad spectrum of colors. Each color is associated with a particular frequency of the wave. And you, as you know, you can split out white light on a prism, and it gives you all these beautiful frequency components of a rainbow. So the question now is there some information in this frequency spectrum? And indeed there is. So that gets us to some experimental results that were quite puzzling in the late 1800s that dealt with discrete optical spectra, photoelectric effect, and the particle-wave duality. All right, so people like to burn things, like some flames. of some gases or burn materials. And those were some of the early experiments. And people sent the light that came out of these flames through a prism. And what they saw is that there's actually a discrete spectrum. It's not a continuum spectrum. And that was quite puzzling. Right? It wasn't clear why that is. All they knew is that is true. And they also find out that it's really a characteristic of each material. It's like a fingerprint. So the hydrogen spectrum, for example, is very different from the iron spectrum. Right? Very different. But, I mean, this might be very natural to you by now, but it was very puzzling to people. And there was no theory that really explained why that is and where that comes from. We use that today even, in big parking lots, right? You might have a sodium lamp, an orangey light, high-powered sodium lamp, where a lot of energy is converted into a single frequency that is visible to the human eye. Out of that really came the development of atomic models, where people said, well, there's these discrete frequencies, and electrons can hop between these local orbits. And when they hop down from an orbit, there's a photon coming out, there's light coming out, and it's of a discrete frequency. That was ultimately developed in a quantum mechanical model where you have different orbitals other than these circular orbits. And that was really the advent of quantum mechanics, in a sense. That where the electrons are standing waves that are bound by a core, and the discrete transitions between energies leads to discrete spectra. Right? So this should be very familiar to you. So that led to the advent of quantum mechanics as such. But then there was another experiment that was very puzzling. Actually, it was first observed in 1839, and it wasn't explained until 55 years later. And here's the experiment. People were shining light on a metallic surface and they saw electrons come out. It's the so-called photoelectric effect. But there were some puzzling things about this. So if there is sort of a binding energy of these electrons in this material, and you set the vacuum level to, say, zero, and there's some binding energy, there shouldn't be if you shine a light, you would think that electrons should gather up some energy until they're ready to come out, right? But it turns out, as soon as you turn on light, the electrons come out. Right? It wasn't like a gathering of energy type effect for them to come out, but they come out immediately. And the increasing the light intensity, so the more, the stronger the light you put in, it increases the number of the electrons, but not their energy. Right? You would normally think you put in more energy, they all have more velocity and come out with a higher energy. But that wasn't the case. That was also not quite understood. And also, if you shine in red light onto this particular metal, I forgot what it was, it will not cause emission, no matter how intense you put the light on there. Okay, so red light didn't cut it, even though you could make it very hot with red light, right? And put in a lot of energy, but these electrons still wouldn't come out. But weak violet light will eject few electrons with very high energy, and what that really meant is that light had to have a minimum frequency or color to excite these electrons. So if that is this minimum frequency, they also found that the emitted electrons have a light energy-dependent energy. So the extra energy they have depends on the difference of the actual frequency of the light coming in minus this minimum energy. Okay? So this really won Einstein the Nobel Prize in 1921, where he declared that light can be described by discrete particles of discrete energy with Planck's constant, E equals HF. That was the fundamental explanation of the photoelectric effect. And that meant light energy is not divisible, it's photons. And you have to have a minimum energy to kick out an electron from the bound state. That means the remaining kinetic energy that you have is the light energy minus the binding energy, and that explains all of these sort of puzzles that existed. Realize it took 55 years for somebody to figure that out. Okay? It wasn't obvious. And the theory is very different from what was known at the time. Okay? And we take this for granted now, even though we don't necessarily think about it on a day-to-day basis. So then the upshot of this, light consists of particles, photons. But I thought light is wave. So what's up with that? So there's this particle wave duality where all particles have wave properties where they can interfere, diffract, and form standing waves. And all waves have particle properties that have momentum, have energy, and can be created or destroyed. And the typical description you choose is, well, depending on what interaction you want to look at. So you use energy and frequency and momentum as typical descriptors, and you use a set of discrete quantum numbers that describe the discreteness when needed. And you choose which one you use depending on your problem that you try to solve. There's no truth in one or the other. Okay? Those two are strongly connected. So, let me try to play some more mind games with you. If electrons and atoms are attracted, say confined, by an atomic core, we know that they have quantized in energy and localized orbitals, right? So that's what we know about quantum mechanics, that's how it was discovered. So, but what if you can confine it in a man-made structure that is small, in a small space, and the material is sort of clean? That sounds like an artificial atom. If you can confine electrons to a small space where there's long coherence times, you create an artificial atom, and that's a quantum dot. So that gets us into figuring out what is a quantum dot and what can we do with it in terms of heterostructures and quantum dots. So one way to describe what quantum dots are it's a well-conducting or low-energy domain surrounded in all three dimensions by a low conducting slash high energy region. And the domain size needs to be roughly of the order of nanometers, which is roughly the wavelength of electrons. And there's a second part, is that you need to look at the electronic structure where the electron energy may be quantized. You end up with an artificial atom, and if you have coupled quantum dots, you might have an artificial molecule. And it contains a countable number of electrons, not an infinite number. So here's one sort of stick diagram example of a sort of a confinement potential. So here's a lower energy material, and it's buffered by a higher energy material. This is a conduction band edge, say, of indium arsenide versus gallium arsenide. And that's what I sort of mean by well-conducting, low-conducting, high-energy, low-energy is sort of a rather general term. You can string these things together where you might have multiple quantum dots, so this is a one-dimensional picture. And why would you care? Because in this artificial atom, you can tune these eigenenergies of this photon absorption spectrum. So you can build detectors, in a sense, which could serve as an input, right? You have light coming in, you sense it, that's an input. But you can also have an electron fall down in energy and emit a photon. That's a laser. That's an output. It's an optical output. And you can have crazy stuff like tunneling from one state to the next through a barrier. And if you do that, you can have electron transport and you occupy these states, and that gives you logic and memory. To have input, output, and logic and memory on the same quantum structure is sort of like the ultimate pipe dream of a device person, right? We don't have that today where all of these components are really on the same chip, in the same material, in the same arrangement. But in a sense, that is the ultimate pipe dream. All right, so here's some images of quantum dots of an S orbital and P orbitals and a pyramidal dot to give you an idea. And so quantum dots or heterostructures are artificial atoms that can be custom designed for a variety of applications. So let me talk a little bit about a resonant tunneling diode. It's a double barrier structure, typically in one dimension. So you have a material variation in one dimension. So here is maybe gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide, gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide, and gallium arsenide on the bottom left. And as you increase the voltage, you pull the emitter, the collector on the right-hand side a little bit down. And as you pull down the collector, you also pull down the resonance, and now you have electrons flow through the structure. So you can have transmission through here. Now if you increase the bias further, what you have is no supply of electrons right here. So there's no electrons that can go through, and the current goes down. Now if you apply a bias further, you have now carrier flow through the second resonance or over this emitter collector barrier here, and the current goes back up. And you end up with this characteristic N-shaped curve. So why would you care? Well, it's kind of odd. You increase the voltage and current goes down. Right? That's very much not like Ohm's law. Right? Ohm's law is sort of here, right? Voltage goes up, current goes up. That's what we're used to. Well, if you're having something like this in this downslope, that's a so-called negative differential conductance or negative differential resistance. Does the opposite of what a normal resistor does. So there's two things you can do with that. One, you can put that into a feedback loop. If you put this device into a feedback loop, that device goes bananas. It likes to oscillate. It's an oscillator. It's a natural oscillator circuit. And the cool thing is it oscillates at the frequency of as high as this thing can go, which is the tunneling time through these barriers, which means terahertz. Forget gigahertz, right? Terahertz. That's pretty fast. The other thing is, if you can build a circuit that likes to latch onto this low part on the bottom here, you could have, imagine, a 1 and a 0, or a 0 and a 1 in a latch circuit. And so you can think about building logic out of these type of devices. Okay? So that's where a lot of this excitement for resonant tunneling diodes came from in the 70s and 80s. So what I'm showing you on the right is, as opposed to the experimental data and a NEMO simulation in black, that's a real device. In fact, there's 12 different IV curves from two different wafers, from three different MESA sizes, and two bias directions. That's all these green dots here. And the black line is prediction before experiment. Okay? Now that's what, on the left you have Mickey Mouse diagrams of concepts. On the right you have real device simulation. In 1994, when the NEMO program sort of started the development of it, the peak to value ratio, the best thing you could get was about 80. 86, I think, was the world record. But to make this viable, it ought to be 1,000. Right? The on-off ratio for a digital circuit should be 1,000. Otherwise, you have a very good space heater. That thing just gets too hot. Which really meant we need to understand where this valley current comes from here. Why is this thing not turning off? What's the physics of this valley current? So by 1997, we were able to basically overlap experiment and theory. And what I'll be talking in this course in big chunks is, where is this valley current coming from? What's the theory behind it? How do you model these devices? And how do you get away from stick diagrams on the left to real device simulation on the right? So here are some example implementation of quantum dots, which are in a sense also RTDs, but in three-dimensional confinement. So here's some indium gallium arsenide dots and quantum and gallium arsenide. They're grown as self-assembled dots. Here's some quantum dots as gated structures. Here's some colloidal quantum dots, and you might have seen these fancy images of cadmium selenide dots that, depending on their size, emit light at different frequencies. There's some applications of thinking about single electron memory, having single electron transistors, or even logic based on quantum cellular automata. Then for quantum dots might be used for medical markers, for quantum computings to shuttle qubits around, or for optical detectors. And the interesting piece here is that quantum dots, normal quantum wells are blind to orthogonal light. So light that comes in from the top, you actually have to turn the light around to make it be absorbed in a quantum well. But quantum dots, since they have a three-dimensional topology, can absorb light even from the straight angle, which is about what this slide is. So here, quantum wells are blind to light impinging orthogonal. You kind of have to turn it around. And what people do is they build all kinds of electromagnetic couplers that actually turn the light around, which reduces overall the efficiency of the coupling overall, but it makes the light even absorbable. Quantum dots, due to their three-dimensional nature, really allow to absorb light even from the orthogonal angle. You don't have to turn it around. Then finally, quantum dots might be useful for lighting, because we might be able to build them for different LEDs, for full-color flat panel displays, and we can make them also for longer wavelengths. Finally, quantum dots could be useful in a different perspective on Moore's law, where instead of looking at just lithography sizes, we can start to look at number of electrons on a gate. And if we were to operate in these devices in a regime where the electron addition energy, the charging energy, is much larger than the thermal budget in the device, that means there is no fluctuation about electron numbers anymore. You could control the number of electrons discretely from 1 to 2 to 3 and do possibly logic and memory in this kind of single electron device, which is also a concept that is being pursued. All right, so that really is sort of concluding the presentation as a motivation on why quantum mechanics is relevant for real devices. And it gave you a little bit of an overview again on classical systems that have particles, propagating waves, standing waves, and chromatography, then strange experimental results with discrete optical spectra, photoelectric effect, and the particle wave duality, and then heterostructures. And finally, I'm going to go into the some of the concepts here on the applications. So NEMO 1D was able to translate these concepts here, these stick diagrams, into quantitative engineering. And what it meant to do was putting the atoms back, putting potentials around these atoms, and treating these atoms electronic structurally correctly in a tight binding description. And what that meant is really we created a new material, not just a new device. And tight binding really allowed us to do that. So an atomistic description of the device allowed us to do this modeling accurately. And we then pursue this with NEMO 3D, where we not only do this in one dimension, but in three dimensions, where we start to map atomic orbitals into realistic device structures that might consist of millions of atoms. And we calculate eigenstates in this system, and then apply that to physical observables with sensors, quantum computing arrays. And really, we do this for millions of atoms. We do this immediately for parallel computing. So parallelism in the software is built in. And we spend a lot of time parameterizing the atomic orbitals and the tight binding to give us the right material properties so we can do this well. So here's some sample wave functions of a pyramidal dot, say S orbital. Then there's a class of P orbitals, but you see that the symmetry can be broken. Then there's a different class of, the next set of orbitals looks like this. And then they get really bizarre looking with overlapping wave functions and all that. And you can get that numerically in NEMO 3D. What's interesting is also to connect that to experimental data where people are measuring coupled quantum dots. That's like an artificial molecule. So if they're far apart from each other, the two states are decoupled. But if you bring the quantum dots closer, they start to be overlapping. And you sort of see the bonding and antibonding nature of quantum mechanics in your artificial molecule, which is kind of an interesting thing to simulate, and people are also experimentally observing this. So that gets me sort of to the conclusion of this lecture, where we've covered classical systems, experimental results, heterostructure and quantum dots, and some of the modeling that follows subsequently. So, with that, I'd like to take any questions. Hopefully it was not too basic for you guys, because you all are PhD students, but I wanted to make sure that we start to talk a little bit about the same language on quantum mechanics and what's important.